From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in. And joining us in the first part of this show is Professor Xiaosu Pu. I hope I pronounced that correctly. She's a professor at the University of Utah, a professor of atmospheric sciences, and she's here to talk about a study, some research they're about to get started in the Heber Valley, looking at all things fog. It sounds so trite and straightforward, but there's a lot of things we don't understand about fog and its formation and its impacts. Her and her students are going to be looking at that. Professor Pu, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Good morning.
So I thought we would start at the very basics. Explain to us how fog forms. And I think we're having fog up here today. So help us explain that.
Yeah, so the fog form usually, so when we have the this water vapor in the air, and so the when temperature drop, it gets saturated. And so, yeah, if the wind condition, we have no wind, so then the fog forms. So it's fog is a cloud near the ground, so basically.
And we read, you know, in a short synopsis of your work that there are several different kinds of fog. There's cold air pool fog and mountain valley cold fog. Like, can you give us a sense of what these different kinds of fog are?
Yeah, the cold pool fog usually is when this inversion forms. We have the deep cold pool in the air condition, and so then you have the this fog form. So we call this cold pool. It's very relatively thick, and stay persistent for a while. And we also have this channel fog form near the ground, so which is relatively channel. So there are all kinds of the fog depend on the atmospheric condition.
Okay, but in other words, you suggested that fog is in many ways simply a cloud that sits right above the ground. It has the same attributes as clouds we might see up in higher up in the in elevation.
Yeah, right? That's right. So basically, yeah, it's a cloud near the ground.
Okay, all right. So talk to us now about this study that's going to be performed in the Heber Valley. What is that all about, and when does it get started?
Yeah, so our cold fog study in the Heber Valley starts in the January 7th, and our field program will be run through January 7th to February 23rd for the six-week period. We will particularly study this cold fog, so which means the fog form near the freezing point or below the specifically below the freezing point.
Below, okay, so fog that forms below a freezing point. Why the Heber Valley?
Yeah, because Heber Valley is an ideal place which has not only this thick fog, but also some of the channel fog, and also over the during the winter, over the night time, Heber Valley temperature usually very low, and they get an ideal place to form the ice fog. Another thing is because Heber Valley is a typical valley form, and so there it has a mountain, has a mountain, the valley basin, and also river around it. It represents the typical mountain valley. So then our study will be very representative because we can apply our results to the other place around the world.
Okay.
So how do you study fog? It sounds like there are a variety of sensors that you'll deploy in the area.
Yes, we get support from the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and so they have their laboratory host all kinds of these ground-based instruments, and they're going to help us to take some measurements. And we also have the collaborate from Environment Canada, and they will facilitate this microphysics instrument, help us to understand the cloud. And we also have Professor Hannah Haller in our department, and she will take these aerosol measurements because this fog formation involves both aerosol and also the water vapor microphysics. And so, yeah, microphysics is all about the phase change of the water. And so this nucleation process is, must be understood in order for us to improve our computer model for the representation of this microphysics and the interaction with the aerosol.
Okay, so what kinds of things exactly will you be measuring? Is it like, you know, the saturation of the air, humidity, visibility? What kinds of factors are you looking at?
Yes, right. So we will, measure all kinds of the cloud microphysics, meaning the saturation and the visibility, and also the property of the microphysics in terms of the ice, ice water content and the liquid water content, and also the size of the particle. So the size distribution, and also the aerosol, and in terms of the air composition, and also the aerosol size distribution.
Now, you have a couple of students with you on this call. They're Jonathan Stoddard and Becca Beal. And if Jonathan or Becca, you want to jump in and tell us what your roles will be in this research. Somebody jump in.
Yeah, so basically Becca and I will be on the forecast team for this project, which basically means we'll be making daily forecasts and uploading it to the website we have online. And hopefully we'll be able to improve our abilities to forecast this fog. That's the whole point of this project. Currently, I have been doing data analysis for ice fog onset and dissipation, and kind of learning how it works in Heber Valley and what to look for. That's basically what I've been doing.
So ice fog, how does that differ from the other types of fog we've been talking about?
So ice fog basically means it's ice crystals in the air instead of water droplets. And that basically forms when the temperature drops below freezing. Mm.
And so I can visually tell the difference between, I'm in ice fog versus I'm in the other type, shallow or thick fog.
The main way you'd be able to tell the difference is because that ice fog would be freezing onto physical, like, say, a fence post. You'd see crystals beginning to form on that. That wouldn't happen with just normal fog with water droplets.
Okay, and Becca, what is your role in this study?
Yeah, so like Jonathan said, we're part of a larger forecasting team, and there will be some outward facing things, putting it on the website so that everyone can see how we're forecasting the events. But also we'll be part of the actual campaign that goes out in some ways, and we'll definitely be a part of briefing people as part of the team to make sure that everyone's appraised of there is gonna be a high impact fog event, that we know what instruments to bring out and exactly what we're going to do that day. And then if there is, you know, maybe off condition that there's bad weather that people know before they go up in the mountains with no cell service. So.
Right.
Oh, always a good idea.
Yeah.
So Jonathan had mentioned that hopefully this data will improve your ability throughout the project of being able to forecast each day what's going to happen. What kinds of information specifically will help you improve that forecast? What are you looking to get out of this?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, most models can't, you know, very accurately make forecasts over the complex terrain. It can't resolve on enough detail that when we get to those mountains or those valleys, and exactly forecast which locations will have fog. I think that's going to be a big portion of what we hope to improve. And also there are some factors that seem very small and aren't forecasted in great detail that do have a big impact, like wind is one of them. So if there's a slight wind, it really inhibits cloud formation and can disturb if it's, you know, going to develop into deeper fog or stay shallow or something. So I think wind in particular is something we're hoping to see resolved at a higher resolution.
Yeah, I think the purpose of this whole project is help to improve the prediction of the fog. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to achieve this goal during the field, but we have the comprehensive post-field study. Because the field program, the main purpose is collect the data, and we are going to use this data to validate our computer weather forecasting model and also improve our model and eventually to achieve the goal to improve the fog prediction.
We're speaking with Professor Xiaosu Pu. She's a University of Utah professor of atmospheric sciences. And we're talking about a study that's going to be there, in part, going to be launching down in the Heber Valley starting in January, first week of January or so, and going through February, analyzing and gathering data about fog, different types of fog, and its formation. We're also talking to a couple of her students who are going to be participating in the study, Jonathan Stoddard and Becca Beal. It's interesting that, you know, of all the meteorological data that's out there and analysis that goes on, we still don't understand well enough the how fog forms and why some fog is, I guess, more dense than others and the different types of fog. And like you say, Professor Pu, this is important for us to for health and safety reasons, I guess, for transportation reasons. I mentioned in the intro that fog is the second largest cause of aircraft accidents after high winds. And so there's a lot of value that goes into the data coming out of this study.
Yeah, I think our data is very unique with this experiment because the fog formation involves the interaction between the microphysics aerosol and the local dynamic condition. It is a complete complicated interaction between the radiation, near surface condition, water vapor, and all this. So we will measure all these related variables. And so this allows us not only understand the processes of the fog formation, but also, as I said, help us to validate computer model and so improve our computer model and eventually help us to do better numerical weather prediction. Mm.
So we've talked a little bit about the impact of fog on airports. And so I have to ask, there's a small airport right there in the Heber Valley. Are they a partner of yours in any way in studying this?
Yeah, there are a partner of us because they will provide data for us. And also their NWS, since they will facilitate their forecaster, so their forecaster will support our field program with our go, no go decision. And the airport there is really helpful.
Who is funding this research, or where does the funding for the research come from?
Yeah, it comes from National Science Foundation, so which sponsors for the basic science research. And also another important goal is to help raise the next generation scientists. So that's why we have students involved.
Oh, students are a great value, right, Professor
Pu? Yeah.
You guys do all the heavy lifting. So we thank you for all your efforts and the work you're going to be doing in this study. Last couple minutes, will this study be online in any way that people can go and maybe maybe citizen science can get involved in providing data or analysis or observations who live down in the Heber Valley?
Oh yeah, I think that since we will set our observation site in many places, and definitely we already in touch with the Heber Valley residents and the people because we are going to use the land for our observation site, and they already help us. Yeah, so also during the field program, we will have the website set up so people can look our data and also even download our data and use our data.
Okay. Well, we have to wrap up. Where can people go? You mentioned online. Is there a website that will be available for people to go to track this study?
Yeah, I think we have our website currently set up as cfact.utah.edu. So, yeah, we just begin build it, but we will add on more content.
Okay, that's great. Well, we appreciate you taking the time to join us and chat about this study. And we look forward to talking to you maybe later next year, when the data has been compiled and analyzed, and we can talk to you about some of the results. It'll be really interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
Great.
Professor Xiaosu Pu with the University of Utah, Jonathan Stoddard, Becca Beal, students at the University of Utah, we thank you for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you. Thank you for the
opportunity.
Thank you very much.
All right. Let's take a break for a couple of underwriters, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Professor Dennis Baldacci. He's professor of biometeorology at the University of California in Berkeley, talking about ecosystem health and how that is measured. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers a mix of modern home furnishings for any lifestyle, with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. Our showrooms offer complete interior design services. We are on the web at sanfrandesign.com for tours and inventory.
Since 1998, Nexus IT supports and protects Utah businesses with managed and co-managed IT services, outsourced IT support, and cybersecurity solutions. Nexus IT is a proud supporter of KPCW. 435-200-5926 or nexusitc.net.
Do you know the most common place kids drink is at home with their parents' permission? Many parents think they're just going to do it anyway, so it's safer at home. This just isn't true. Your firm disapproval of alcohol is the number one reason your kids choose not to drink. Our kids can't keep boundaries we haven't clearly set. Empower your kids to make better choices. For more information, visit ctcsummitcounty.org. Communities That Care is a local nonprofit and proud KPCW supporter.
Hello, this is Diane Reinhart with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We are a proud supporter of KPCW and have been providing our clients with real estate services since 1976. All current and active listings can be found on our website at bhhsutah.com, and our agents can help navigate the real estate market.
This is Brian Richards, executive producer of Mountain Town Music, a nonprofit organization and proud supporter of KPCW. I'm passionate about providing live music to our community, which enhances the well-being of the mind, body, and soul. Did you know this past summer, Mountain Town Music showcased 757 local Utah musicians on various stages throughout Summit County? On November 5th, our community will come together for 24 hours of giving. More information at livepcgivepc.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us now for the second segment of the show is Dennis Baldacci, professor of biometeorology at the University of California, Berkeley, here to talk with us about measuring the health of terrestrial ecosystems. Professor Baldacci, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Pleased to join you today.
Well, the first question that Chris and I have for you is, what is biometeorology?
Right.
Ah, well, that's a good question. It's a study of really life and weather and climate and how it helps plants respond to temperature, sunlight, rainfall, helps us understand when plants might leaf out or drop leaves, how different ecosystems are located in different parts of the world due to their climate, and how things kind of respond. Also leads to interest in irrigation and water use by plants, and as you're interested in issues about carbon uptake by ecosystems.
Well, that's fascinating.
But it also goes into other aspects, which I don't study, is how weather can affect human response or cattle or area livestock. So it's a very broad topic that has a long, long history.
Okay. Well, it's fascinating and something we've never really dug into,
right,
per se before. And today we're talking about your recent study looking at terrestrial ecosystems, and I think trying to figure out how to measure their health and their function in a simplified way. And you found that there are kind of three main variables that help you do this. Can you give us like an overall, you know, a thumbnail sketch of this research?
Oh, sure. Well, ecologists for a long time have been trying to figure out how to maybe simplify lots of complex data to understand how plants photosynthesize, breathe, take up carbon dioxide. And a lot of our colleagues have worked on leaves and trying to look at plant traits. Now, realize there's over 400,000 species of plants, and so the big question is, does every species have its own way of working, or are there commonalities? There's shared ways of doing this, limited amounts. And so they found at the leaf scale that there's, you know, four or five key traits that everything aligns up in terms of telling us about how much photosynthesis may occur in different parts of the world. It gets back to simple things about how much nitrogen is in a leaf. What's the area to weight ratio, for example? What's the longevity? So this type of leaf work has inspired us as ecosystem ecologists to look at this at the whole ecosystem scale. So we run a global network of these flux systems that have instrumentation that measures turbulence and up and down movement of the air. And as that up and down movement of the air occurs, there'll be parcels of air with high and low CO2 that are affected by the ability of the plants to photosynthesize or respire, to take up CO2 and to respire it and lose it. So averaged over many, many years in many, many places of the world, we're trying to find out whether whole ecosystems also have a limited set of traits that help us simplify reorganize what's going on. And that's what we found in this paper. Some of the main drivers were these indices such as, again, photosynthetic potential, you know, how much nitrogen is in the plant ecosystem, and that will lead to some ecosystems having much higher rates of carbon uptake than maybe more native and nitrogen-poor ecosystems. There's another one called water use efficiency, the ratio of carbon uptake to water use. And then finally, there is one called carbon use efficiency. That's kind of the ratio of how much respiration is needed for each unit of carbon that's assimilated by the ecosystems. So it's a new way to look at whole ecosystems and try to find some commonalities, essentially.
So with respect to, say, the water use efficiency, it's not just the fact that you might have a ecosystem might have plenty of water, but that's how the plants or the vegetation efficiently takes that water up?
Yeah, no, very much so. There's kind of this dual effect that goes on. So plants have evolved to have these stomata that open up and close to allow carbon dioxide to enter the plant to drive photosynthesis. But the problem is, the more open you have those stomata to increase more photosynthesis, you lose more water going out through transpiration. Mm. And so there has to be kind of this optimal value. And depending on how arid the landscape you have, how dry the soil is, the stomata are more apt to open and close. But when you start working at whole ecosystems, it gets even a little more complicated, because how dry the landscape is will also affect how many plants are on the landscape and how much area of their leaves will occur. And so these are kind of a, we call a scale emergent property of the whole ecosystem. And you all living in Utah know this very, very well. As you go up to higher in the mountains where it rains more, you'll see much denser forests. And as you go down more into the desert, you'll see fewer and fewer plants. And so nature has kind of worked hard in an interesting way to help regulate and give enough water for the plants that are there to allow them to thrive. Clearly, there's just not enough water to have a closed canopy of endless plants in the drier portions of Utah and the range, for example. Mm-hmm.
So given those like contrasting ecosystems you just mentioned, you know, like high mountains with dense forests and, you know, red rock desert, can you compare those two ecosystems for their health against one another, or can you use the same, like those same markers for such vastly different environments?
Well, this is what's kind of cool about these traits is they all kind of maybe converge on a line. They may not be at the same point, but if you're trying to look at one variable versus another, they'll be on different parts of that line, so we can actually draw some conclusions. And that's also the power of having data from a wide range of ecosystems for the world. It's just not this random scatter plot. There's order to the chaos, as I like to tell my students.
Well, I have to ask next, how can you possibly measure something on an ecosystem scale? How can you possibly measure, like, water use efficiency on an ecosystem scale? I'm so curious.
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of being a biometeorologist. We have this technique called the eddy covariance method. It's been around since the 1950s. And so essentially what we're doing is we go out to the woods, we have a tall tower, and on this tower we have really two major bits of information and sensors. One's called a three-dimensional sonic anemometer, and it's measuring instantaneous wind velocity 10, 20 times a second. It's measuring updrafts, it's measuring wind coming towards you, and we then look at simultaneously measurements of water vapor and carbon dioxide fluctuations, and the sensors are side by side. We look at these paired measurements, and we average them over a half hour, and from that we actually measure what's called a flux. We are measuring the number of grams or moles per meter squared per second averaged over the whole forest landscape, and we're actually averaging what all the trees upwind are doing for several hundred meters.
Wow.
Now the beauty is computers now allow us to store vast amounts of data. Our sensors are really well developed. The companies like Campbell Scientific in Logan, Utah, and Licor in Lincoln, Nebraska have really been critical to building robust sensors. And now these sensors can work year-round in all types of weather. We now have sites operating over 20 years now. And so we've really had to revolutionize how we can measure the breathing of the biosphere. In the past, ecologists would have simply gone out and measured diameter, breast height of the trees, and maybe wait 5 or 10 years and measure them again, or trees down and count the tree rings. And they may do some soil surveys where they dig holes and they measure the amount of carbon. But those are very episodic, and they're almost binary, and they take years to accumulate enough differences where we can just see the ups and down drafts day by day, hour by hour, year by year. It is amazing, I have to admit. Quite excited with using this technique.
Yeah, it's just incredible the capability that you have to study this now. I'm curious the scale of this project. So I know this is an international collaboration. How many of these stations do you have, and give us a sense of where they are?
Oh my God, I've lost track. We started out with a small group back in 1995, and it's grown to hundreds within North America and Latin America, Europe, Asia. There might be several thousand sites going on right now. It really is amazing. And what we're trying to do is get scientists, because it is publicly funded for the most part, to share data and then provide these data to the general public. So we work very closely with our colleagues at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, who created wonderful databases that you as a citizen, as a teacher, can download these data and look how they're performing, essentially. And so if you have questions about a forest in Colorado, my colleague at Utah, David Bowling, has been working at Niwot Ridge for decades now, and so his data is there, essentially. I think he also has some sites in the desert of the southwest of Utah that he's performed over the years. And it's fun. You get to know people from all over the world, really become a global community. And we're training the next generation. You know, we're really in this stage of kind of a transfer of leadership. I was the PI for the first 20 years or so, and now my young colleague Trevor Keenan is taking over the next level of the FlexNet project. We're funded by the National Science Foundation and Department of Energy and a few other agencies, essentially.
It's incredible how long-standing this research is, you know, to have been able to fund a project like this for a few decades at this point. Is that unusual?
It is, but it's also the right thing. When you think of ecosystems, you have to think about ecosystem timescales. And so in the early days, there was still kind of a bias that people thought long-term measurements were just monitoring. They weren't first-rate science. But no, every year is different. You're seeing different climates. The ecosystems are different stages of development since they've had disturbance. You really need to have like long-term measurements. And the reality now is that the climate and weather is changing. So our first bit of data really is kind of a baseline, and now we're starting to see how whole ecosystems are responding to high and low rainfall, to extreme temperatures, both high and low. The length of growing seasons are changing as the climate's changing. We're able to see this and quantify it. And then this information is put into the state-of-art ecosystem climate models, so they can do a better job in projecting mechanistically what's happening into the future. So we're really using the scientific method to have this mix of data, of measurements, of models, statistics, to really build up and deconstruct the processes that are occurring both at the whole ecosystem scale and its components, the soils, the roots, the leaves.
Well, if you're
just a lot of people, a lot of time.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dennis Baldocci, professor of biometeorology at the University of California, Berkeley, about measuring the health of terrestrial ecosystems. And you kind of provided a nice segue for us into this. So now that you have been measuring this for so long, what kinds of results or changes are you seeing, and are there trends across the ecosystems that are being studied?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing we're just diving into, since we have a long enough record, about 20 years, is to what degree is water use of ecosystems changing? And this gets back to this comment on scale. If you look at just very simple models, one would think as the surface gets warmer, the humidity of the surface may have more moisture that will drive more water into the atmosphere, and that there may be more and more water use in a warmer world, which could be a problem if there's water limitations. Our long-term data so far are showing that this is not quite happening, that so far things are kind of flat, which is a good thing for the arid West, where we really haven't seen a major increase of evaporation. And this is because the reality is there's kind of a convergence between a demand for more water with a warmer surface versus the supply of energy that drives that actually decreases when the surface is warmer, because there's less energy to drive evaporation. And so it's kind of muting this effect. Whether this continues into the future with more warming, I don't know. Whether this occurs also in wetter environments, I don't know. But based on our data in California, this is what we're seeing. And we want to look at more sites to figure this out into the future.
Well, in a warmer world that is either drier in some locations and wetter in others, resiliency and adaptation are kind of the buzzwords these days. So are you seeing vegetative landscapes of one type or another acting with greater resiliency or adaptation, or is that a little too early to tell?
Yeah, well, I guess maybe your point with our oak savannas, that's probably what's kind of happening. On the other extreme, though, we've seen major mortality for the mid-alpine forest in California. But that's because, again, management. The forests have overgrown, and there's just too many trees on that landscape given the limited amount of water, like I mentioned. You know, your deserts are smart because they've already adapted. Mm-hmm. Our mid-forests, I think, we took fire out, and we let the forest overgrow, and now that we have dry years, there's lots of mortality, and maybe there'll be a reshakeout, and maybe they'll get back to more of a natural equilibrium that should be there given the amount of water and the need to have periodic fires and to clear out the understory and the brush. So yeah, it's really complicated because there's issues of humans and how we manage landscape, plus the forcings of warmer temperature, hot, wetter and drier conditions, and higher CO2. So it remains a very complex topic to tease out.
I'm interested that you mentioned fire. It's something we've been talking about a fair amount lately because we had a small forest fire here in our community. And we've been thinking about the health of the ecosystem as it recovers. So, you know, how do these measurements change when there is a fire? You know, if you have a forest that hasn't burned in many years and then it does burn, how long does that, you know, I guess what I'm really asking is, are your metrics, do they work for that evolution post-fire as a forest kind of regrows?
Great question. This gets back to your first one, how long should we make measurements? And this is one of the reasons we need long-term measurements. My colleague Bev Law, who you contacted earlier, has done wonderful work on fire in Oregon, and Thomas Kolb and his group at Northern Arizona University did lots of studies on, these are all ponderosa pine ecosystems, so they're able to kind of see there's a fire and how does the forest respond, essentially. So clearly the first year you have the fire, you're losing a lot of carbon to the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But what happens in a way is you don't lose as much as you think, because there's often a lot of what's called snags, standing dead trees, that are still there. It takes them a few years for them to actually finally rot and have wind blow for them to fall down and touch the soil. Then when these logs are actually touching the soil, they get wet, the microbes are able to break down the carbon and cause that carbon to go back to the atmosphere. So that's the loss. But also, now there's an opportunity for all the new seedlings to grow. And it takes them, you know, 5, 10, 20 years for them to start becoming mature and filling in the gaps. So you'll go from a period of a pulse of carbon being lost to slowly reduced loss to crossing zero to having a net gain. And the biggest question is, and it depends on the ecosystem and the climate, is how many years does it take to cross that zero line and then become a strong carbon sink again? And this is all natural processes that occur everywhere with Western forests.
You know, we've been talking mostly about, say, forests here, of course, the Utah, arid environments. Does these measurements work in, say, wetland systems too? Can they be applied to wetland systems or even, say, marine-based estuaries or so?
That's the work I'm doing right now. And again, this is the beauty of our technology. Our colleagues have been able to develop sensors now that work on low power that run off of solar panels. And so we're able to actually put these sensors in the middle of nowhere where the questions are interesting. When I first started this wetland work, we needed AC power, and we needed these pumps that drew huge amounts of power, and we couldn't go where the wetland questions are, and now we are. And this is fascinating because here in California, these wetlands actually are some of the best natural carbon solutions. They are taking up vast amounts of carbon dioxide, and because they're flooded, the respiration is greatly decreased. And this actually leads to long-term storage of carbon in the form of peat. Peat starts forming. Mm-hmm. The only negative, there's always never a free lunch with ecosystems, is that the flooding also causes another type of microbe to produce methane. So the more productivity you have from the wetter ecosystems, the fresher ecosystems, you're also producing more methane. We have an estuary here in California, so as we go to the San Francisco Bay, there's more and more saline conditions. The salinity then will reduce the carbon uptake, but also reduces the methane. And so these are the lessons we're learning on how to kind of best use different types of ecosystems to help pull carbon out of the atmosphere for the long term.
Right.
Well, as a land manager and specifically a wetland manager here in Park City, I have to ask, you know, once you have this data, how can you apply that? Like, how can we use that to say, okay, here's how we can help this ecosystem be healthier or pull more carbon out of the atmosphere once we have the data from the research?
Yeah, you know, we try to take these fancy data and make simple engineering type relationships. Often these data that we have are being used to generate algorithms for carbon markets. And my colleague Jim Morris has created the marsh equilibrium model that's being used right now to help land managers to understand how much carbon is being taken up. Bev Law's worked with Dick Waring and others using this 3PG model that helps managers understand how much carbon is being taken up from forests, just using satellite remote sensing. So we're actually doing a lot of handshaking with our direct measurements to inform and improve models and remote sensing products that infer the fluxes so we can scale up elsewhere. Because what we do is expensive. It takes a lot of people to do the work. And so you really can't put these flux towers on every place you want. But given this idea of these traits I mentioned earlier, is that there are some general principles that we can derive from these measurements, and then we can use them for practical applications for land managers like yours. And this is the type of idea we're trying to promote. So I'm really happy to talk to you on this, essentially.
Well, it fits in so well with our community's goals of getting to net zero and looking at ways to decrease our carbon impact. And so when I hear about this, I think we should be looking at our local ecosystems and seeing what we can do here.
And how?
So one, I guess, limitation is that this method I use, is any covariance, needs to be fairly flat land. So it doesn't work as well in really steep mountain terrain. So that's been kind of our one limitation.
So far.
The Niwot Ridge work in Colorado is at, I think, 10,000 feet on a large ridge up near, in the Rockies. So.
Right.
Well, but you have local people. Larry Hipps is a friend of mine at Utah State, and he does this work quite well, so you should contact him down the road.
Perfect.
I got a question from a listener who just wants to know if, again, circling back to a warming world, are there ecosystems that may actually benefit from a warmer world?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, it depends. What we found with the deciduous forest is warming can cause them to have an earlier spring. That gives them a longer growing season, and it can have a potential to take up more carbon over their growing season. But if there is limited water, the drought may occur late in the season and then inhibit that increase. So there's kind of a tight relationship there that we're still trying to understand. And sometimes the years with the earlier springs also are years that do have drought. And so it's complicated, but possibly. And maybe some of the more conifer forests that might benefit from a longer growing season, although often they have hot summer days that cause them to lose carbon.
Well, we have to wrap up. Where can people go to learn more about this research online, let's say?
Yeah, if they Google Ameriflux, they should be able to find data sets from the American systems. And if they Google Fluxnet, FLUXNET, they can find lots of information. And we have lots of papers that have been published also that are available to the public.
Fantastic. Well, I think we have some new collaborations that we need to get on top of here in town. This is Dennis Baldocci, professor of biometeorology at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You're very welcome. Thank you for covering this topic. And you have a good day.
Thank you.
You too. I think biometeorology, Chris, it might be my new favorite field of science.
I think Swanner needs to have some...
A staff biometeorologist.
There you go.
We're looking for a sponsor.
Figure it out. Get some funding for that first.
That's right.
All right. Well, let's take a break, real quick break for underwriters, and we come back. I do have a story I want to share about gasoline-powered leaf blowers.
All right.
The scourge of the earth. My new scourge of the earth.
We'll be noise pollution, air pollution.
It's all of it. You won't believe it. This green earth. We'll be right back.
Do you have an old car, RV, or boat taking up space in your yard? Donate it to KPCW. You'll receive a tax credit, and we receive a donation. We'll take care of everything. Just call 435-649-9004. Thank you for your support.
Amal is a 9-year-old Syrian girl.
She's very curious. She's a bit mischievous.
Who also happens to be an 11-foot-tall puppet.
Yeah, she's very, very big.
And for months, she's been walking across Europe with an important message.
I hope she gives hope to many people.
Special Delivery. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Saturdays at 10 a.m. on KPCW.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And we brought, and by we, I mean Chris, brought some news, brought an update on one of our favorite topics, leaf blowers.
And it's not heat tape.
And it's not heat tape, but it's not a hot tubs.
To crusade. This is about gasoline-powered leaf blowers.
And
okay. Let's make that initial distinction.
Well, I want to say that I've already gotten a text message here saying, whoa, my battery-powered leaf blower is amazing.
Yes. All right. I'm all in on electric-powered leaf blowers. They're quieter. They may not they may be as efficient as gasoline power. But the thing is, we need to discontinue the use of gasoline powered leaf blowers in this town, this county, and swap them out for electric blowers. Or even better now, how about a broom? Maybe that. Okay, here's the story. This
Shocking.
Is from Margaret Rankle, who writes op-eds the New York Times. She covers all things about the environment. She's a great, great writer. I'll just read through. We got a few minutes. Here's what she says. The gasoline-powered leaf blower exists in a category of environmental hell all its own, spewing pollutants, carbon monoxide, smog-forming nitrous oxides, carcinogenic hydrocarbons, basically unburned gasoline and oil because it's two-stroke engines.
Right. I mean, I think I read that like as much as a third of the fuel that you put into leaf blowers, these gas-powered leaf blowers, actually just gets spewed and not even burnt, right? Not even spent.
Here it is. A 2011 study, because this has been known for quite a while, by Edmonds, who deal with internal combustion engines, cars, trucks, etc., found that a two-stroke gasoline-powered leaf blower spewed out more pollution than a 6,200-pound Ford F-150 pickup truck. Edmonds noted that hydrocarbon emissions from a half hour of yard work with one of these two-stroke gasoline-powered leaf blowers are about the same as a 3,900-mile drive from Texas to Alaska in a Ford F-150. That's how inefficient two-stroke engines are, and that's why there's the additional information why we have to if cities or counties need to establish ordinances banning two-stroke leaf blowers, it needs to happen because it's been done already.
That is a shocking amount of impact from a
study done
minor activity.
University of Central Florida by one of my professors looked at the amount of pollutants put into the atmosphere in the Orlando area, and landscaping equipment. That has included mowers and etc.
Okay, probably lots of other small two-strokes.
And leaf blowers was the major source of air pollutants during the summer.
Okay.
That more so than vehicles. So there is an impact here from this, and it's serious. And if we want to be an environmentally mindful town that we are, then we need to take a look at this.
Well, it's also worth noting that in addition to kind of the sustainability piece of it, it's hugely impactful, it seems, to human health. So probably to the people using these machines and those living around them with all the carcinogenic hydrocarbons and nitrous oxides.
And noise, you mentioned.
Right, and the noise.
They can produce more than 100 decibels of low-frequency wall-penetrating sound. I know because I hear those leaf blowers for roughly... Claire, you and I live in Raccoon Club Village, our producer, and we hear those leaf blowers every Friday or Thursday or Friday for hours while they go around and just blow dust and pollen and bacterial matter, dried feces and such into the air. Just so grass clippings aren't on our sidewalks and on our roads.
I like the idea of an old-fashioned rake.
All right.
Get your exercise.
Yes, and
a
broom.
A broom. A rake.
So the article goes on. It's Margaret Rankle, New York Times op-ed. We got to probably have
to just I'm going to add one comment to this. You were talking about the research in Florida. Well, look at this. Lawn care equipment creates more pollution in California than cars do.
That's what it is. And more than 100 cities across the country have already passed regulations to ban or restrict gas-powered leaf blowers. So the answer and the solutions are already there. We don't have
We've got powerful battery-powered leaf blowers. We've got electric leaf blowers.
I hope
we've got the options.
We are going to crusade this.
Is county council listening? City council.
Yep. We have all and county. Yeah, we have all winter to get this changed. To get this. These leaf gasoline-powered leaf blowers replaced by electric-powered leaf blowers. All right, that's it.
All right.
For now.
I have a feeling you'll be hearing more about this, but in the meantime, we have to wrap up today's show. And as always, we want to thank our underwriters who make the show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Utah Open Lands Conservation Association,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
and of course, listeners like you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.